This is going to be a review of our study in Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 of our evidence course with Professor Carol Buckner. First, we saw there are several sources for the law of evidence. One source is the Constitution. A second source is common law. A third source, and the one we will primarily be focusing on, is the federal rules of evidence. We are going to look in detail at the actual rules themselves and also at the commentary. We will see that in many cases, the federal rules codify common law. In addition, because the California rules are tested on the California bar exam, we are also going to be comparing the California Evidence Code provisions as we go through the course. As we will see, in many cases, the two codes are very similar, but in some cases, there are significant differences. You will notice that the law of evidence is heavily discretionary in that judges do have quite a bit of discretion to admit evidence or not. And also, judges make preliminary determinations, as we will see. The appellate review of evidentiary rulings is very deferential to the trial judge's discretion. Typically, an abuse of discretion standard is followed. Attorneys also have discretion whether or not to object to the admission of evidence in the first place. This course will focus very heavily on trial procedure, so be sure that you understand the terminology that is covered in Chapter 1. First, pretrial motions in limine. These are motions that are made right before trial to exclude evidence or to obtain a ruling to permit introduction of evidence. Next, jury selection. This is the process by which lawyers select jurors from a pool of eligible candidates. Next, lawyers exercise peremptory challenges and are able to challenge jurors for bias or for other reasons. Next, opening statements are given. These are statements made by the lawyers but are not considered evidence. Rather, they are an outline of what the evidence will show in the case. Next, the case in chief is presented by the plaintiff or prosecutor, which involves the efforts of those lawyers to prove the elements of the claim or the crime that is charged. As the witnesses are presented, direct examination is conducted by the party calling each witness. The opposing party then conducts cross-examination. After the case in chief, the defendant's case is presented. The defendant can rebut the evidence presented in the case in chief and also can prove any defenses that the defendant believes are applicable. Next, the plaintiff or prosecutor presents its case in rebuttal. Finally, closing arguments are presented. This is a summation by attorneys for the jury regarding what the evidence showed and an effort to put the story together for the jury. It also includes argument regarding the proof in reference to the elements of the crime or claim. After the closing arguments, the jury receives instructions. Written instructions are submitted by the lawyers, then read to the jury by the judge. The jury then conducts its deliberations in which it considers the evidence and ultimately renders its verdict, which is the jury's decision. That concludes a summary for Chapter 1. Now let's turn to Chapter 2, which involves the topic of relevance. In this chapter, we looked at three topics. First, whether evidence is relevant or irrelevant. This involves a key test, evidence that has a tendency to make a fact of consequence to the case more or less probable than without the evidence is considered relevant. This is also often referred to as a test of logical relevance. The next topic we studied was the consideration of probative value versus unfairly prejudicial evidence. What we will see here is that judges have the discretion to exclude even relevant evidence if it is unfairly prejudicial, duplicative, or a waste of time. The third topic in this chapter was conditional relevance. We see here that the judge has discretion whether to admit certain evidence that depends on the fulfillment of a condition. If the court finds there is sufficient evidence for a jury to find the fulfillment of that condition, then the judge will admit the evidence. Let's look at the basic federal rule regarding relevance. Relevant evidence is defined as evidence that has any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence to the determination of the action more or less probable than it would be without the evidence. That's the federal rule. How does the California rule compare? The rule is similar, but it adds another example that is significant. California rule also provides that relevant evidence includes evidence relevant to credibility of a witness or hearsay declarant. And then again, relevant evidence is defined as evidence that has any tendency in reason to prove or disprove a disputed fact that is of consequence to the action. So California also adds the concept of a disputed fact. In contrast, the federal rule is a little more liberal because it permits a broader scope of background evidence to be introduced. Overall, the evidence rules regarding relevance are very undemanding. We learn that all evidence that is irrelevant should be excluded, but that in contrast, relevant evidence that is admissible may be subject to numerous exceptions. We looked at a series of cases to learn that evidence does not have to be conclusive in order to be admissible on the grounds of relevance. All that is needed is a logical connection. For example, we saw in the Dominguez case that the ownership of the gun by the defendant did not have to conclusively prove the defendant murdered the victim. All that was needed was a logical connection so that the evidence would be considered relevant. Next, we looked at the topic of probative value versus unfair prejudice, and I emphasize the idea of unfair prejudice here. All relevant evidence is potentially prejudicial, otherwise it wouldn't be relevant. But we are only concerned with evidence that is unfairly prejudicial. So, for example, in the McRae case, we see that photos of the deceased are relevant and should not be excluded under this rule because they show the cause of the shooting of the victim. We learned that courts can exercise discretion to exclude evidence for a number of reasons. One of those is the ability to exclude evidence that creates jury confusion. We saw this in the Noriega case, where the court excluded evidence of Noriega's involvement with the CIA because it was not very relevant to his case, which involved drug trafficking, and could also be a source of jury confusion. One important Supreme Court case we read in this section was the Old Chief case, where the court excluded the details of the underlying felony record of the defendant, where the defense was willing to stipulate that he, in fact, was a felon in a felon in possession of a firearm case. The court said that the details of his prior felony record were not necessary and could be unfairly prejudicial. Now, the court did emphasize that normally a prosecutor should be able to submit evidence that a jury would expect to be presented with in order to tell a complete story. The last topic on relevance involves conditional relevance, the idea here being that sometimes evidence is only relevant if other evidence shows foundational facts. The procedure here is for the court to determine whether, as a preliminary matter, the foundational evidence is sufficient for a jury to find those underlying facts. Notice that the judge is not determining the truth of the foundational facts, only whether there is enough evidence for a jury to find that they exist. That's the end of this first summary on Chapter 1 and 2.